Hello, dear listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast that's overdosed horribly on Botox this week, and will be waiting in this cage at the police station until it sorts itself out. I'm Nathan.
I'm James.
I'm Adam.
And I'm a 405 line Joyce Grenfell face suck off upper mooring mast for this one.
As usual. It's London 1953, which can only mean that it's time for a delightfully domestic celebration of privilege, imperialism, and aristocracy. So please join us as we gather round in the living room to watch The Idiot's Lantern. So, Adam, David Tennant's hair, yes or no?
No. Like, I didn't. Just all around, like before the 50s and after. I haven't had hair since the 90s, so maybe it's jealousy.
Well, none of us has, really. I actually found the Next Time trailer a bit of a relief.
Well, although it was because I hadn't seen it in a few years. The Next Time trailer, I was like, I remember his hair being way more sticky uppy. It looked flatter than I remembered.
It is unfortunate.
It's, yeah, it hasn't aged as well as some of the other parts of the show.
No. We would call them coxcombs in the period.
Yeah. Or DAs. Like, yeah, duck's ass hair.
DAs or they? Tony Curtis cuts. Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, we're all Spartacus here. It's the whole period thing. Well, actually, this just comes down to, are we codifying bits of Tennant, or are we actually talking about how we receive Tennant? Are we back on that one again?
Receive
Tennant?
I think it will turn out that a lot of these episodes have us expressing reservations for Tennant's performance, and there's plenty of it here.
A lot of it. A lot of performance.
Yeah. It's a lot of teeth, a lot of face pulling.
Do you know what I found, like, towards the back half of the episode? I kind of realized that, you know, not a lot of people are fans of season 3.
Yeah.
And I think Tennant is only as good as who we're standing next to. And the back half of this episode feels a bit meh because
no Billy.
Billy Piper's gone faceless into a cupboard.
Yeah.
I think that was in David's contract.
At least one faceless Billy a month.
Billy must get off her face at least once in a season.
I have heard some stories. Anyway.
That's being it.
Yeah, I think he's only as good as who he's playing off against. Like, I think he's a great straight man, but he's annoying.
Yeah.
As the comedic.
No one's called him a cipher before, but I think you're really onto something there.
I think there's some problem, and, you know, again, it'll come up again and again and again. But when he is doing that accent, I think, you know, he's an incredibly skilled actor and he's very good at accents, but I do think saddled with that accent and doing that voice means that there's rarely any sort of interiority. It's all kind of surface, I think.
I think that's what he's like as an actor, full stop. I think he's just one of these people that is really good at remembering their lines, not bumping into the furniture, and, you know, whatever people see beneath the surface is well, down to people who can see things beneath the surface that aren't there.
Right. There's a reason a lot of teenage girls still, who were teenage girls at the time, still have that palpable Tony Curtis, Cliff Richard / affection for him.
That's one of the ironic parts of this episode is where he's like, oh, yeah, your mum would love Cliff. And it's like, look who's talking.
When did you ever get tied up on a rope by Kenny Everett and slashed on TV? You would wish for such career heights.
But, yeah, I think he's talented at what he does. But it's, I don't know, all the gurning and mucking around. It's especially after someone with the gravitas of Eccleston. Mm. And this is what? We're only halfway through this season.
Yeah, exactly, so halfway point.
Yeah, so it's, you know, we're just sort of coming to grips with who he is as the Doctor. And, like, I loved him when he was on, but now I kind of, I don't know, I find it a little bit annoying.
I think I'm circling back around. I felt the same way. I loved him when he was on. And then I kind of thought, maybe it's my least favorite performance from a modern doctor. And now when I watch it often, but not always, I'm relieved that it's not as bad as I feared it was going
to
be.
Yeah.
But certainly he gets one big kind of snarling hero moment where Rose comes in sort of faceless and now suddenly it's personal, you know, despite the fact that dozens of other people are sort of faceless in a cage at the police station.
So was he going to leave him?
He was all right with it. And that performance is sort of, that's upsettingly terrible, I think.
I think Uros Lynn is a great director of action, and like I love all the wacky angles and it's a great looking episode, but I don't think he's ever really chosen great guest stars.
But we do have Ron Cook.
I really like him. I like that he underpedals, because what else can you do when you've got the tenant storm in the room, the oncoming whisper,
then shut.
I really, really do like Ron Cook. I've seen him on stage over in the UK. He's amazing.
Yeah. I don't know. I liked some of the performance. I liked Nan, but, you know, she was gone very quickly.
She was Megan Jones in Fury from the Deep.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Is she old Nan from the Game of Thrones?
Yes.
Yes. Who passed away and was eulogized in the first episode.
Yeah.
Poor love.
Wow.
Yeah, she's great. I loved her. Yeah. Derek from EastEnders gives me the irrits, though.
That's Eddie Connolly?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The dad. Ugh.
It's a really, really weirdly misjudged performance. About Time says that everyone's acting like they're in a different production.
Yes.
Apart from him who's acting like he's in a school play. It is.
It's like Samuel Beckett was 14 and writing the book and none of the characters are actually talking to each other. That's a problem I find, though, with modern pieces. You tell me what you think, that when they try and do a period piece of 20th century, especially the BBC, they get it totally wrong. Adventure in Time and Space. Now, we love the Big Finish audios, and you know we've got the wonderful David Bradley back doing those with the Adventures in Spoon and whatever cast. But the lovely Gemma who plays Barbara, there's no tonal variance. It is, I'm doing this as an RP person.
Oh, my God.
And she look, you know, just that is not what actors have ever been. We actually got more naturalism back then.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of the same here. There haven't been any RP voices on the BBC and on the radio anyway, since 2013 when they exorcised Charlotte Green. From the News Quiz, whom the fabulous Jeremy Hardy described as sonic Viagra. And she was saying, you know, you don't hear people like me anymore, except on this podcast. So there is that sense of, oh, no, we're performing rather than giving us some naturalism. They actually get it more right when they go back to the 19th century than they do here.
I think here he is a big problem because he's
such a linchpin of the story that everyone's kind of, you know, thrown out of orbit by the fact that he's so off kilter.
It is really important, isn't it? And he nearly completely obscures the point of the story. Mm. And as you were saying before, Adam, it is thin. I mean, there's not that much to it. But it's clearly about that generation that went through the war and, you know, we're getting a sunnier future, you know, the doctor says, and we're going to be moving into a more modern Britain in the 60s and things, and that's going to be sort of Tommy's generation and he's kind of left behind. And I think there's some room to have some sympathy with him, but he is such a horrible, shouty character.
Obviously, the script's written for us to have sympathy with him. Like when Tommy goes off to, you know, carry his suitcase at the very end, and it's like, oh, so we're meant to think that there was a human inside this over-the-top lunacy that's been going on. Yeah, I think that, like, that's my biggest problem with it. There are things I love about this episode, though. Any time I see Maureen Lipman, I get excited.
She's so great.
Well, you know that she wanted to be in it for ages. Yeah. And you know her. Have you seen her shtick over there, her Joyce Grenfell readings?
No,
which is where I was coming from. She's obsessed in an unnatural lady fashion with the works of Joyce Grenfell. Wow. So if you remember her from the she wasn't ever in Carry On, but she was in St. Trinian's.
She was in the new Carry On, wasn't she? The one with Julian Clary?
Carry On Columbus.
No, she'd passed by then.
So what? Joyce Grenfell. I thought you were talking about Maureen Littman.
She's the Olivia Colman. But yeah, she does this lovely piece, and she's done this stand-up thing for years reading Grenfell's poetry, which is very funny and very much about the constraints and about just pushing gently. She was a Christian Scientist,
Grenfell. Wow.
Oh, wow.
Really darkly humoured, as you would be.
Like Joan Crawford. She is a Christian Scientist, wasn't she?
God, this is everything to me. It explains so much. They all were suffering with appendicitis. That's going to give you real grist for your performance. But she loves this period, and she's quite obsessed with this whole notion. And the really telling thing, I'd like to hear Gatiss talk about this, you would never have had a Maureen Lippman.
No.
Because she's too Jewish.
Too Jewish.
And her enunciation is actually still not quite right, just because we're the kind of people that pick on that kind of thing. But that I suppose as a meta thing, it's quite interesting. I love Mark Gatiss's writing. I just never get to see what it is on screen because three quarters of it, it's always cut out. So all the beautiful ideas and the richness of his text get there.
I thought the best production of one of his scripts was the most recent one, The Empress of Mars.
Yeah.
Like that all felt like it was there. I saw everything that I was expecting, because there's like a moment where in this one where Tommy's talking, kind of implying that, you know, he might have feelings for people, and you're like,
it's as neutral as that.
Yeah, like you're like, what are you saying?
You know, in the original script, Tommy was supposed to actually have a crush on the Doctor.
There you go.
And it was written for Eccleston as well.
Yeah,
well, it all makes sense.
From season from series one.
Who would have said Eccles would have minded?
Well, and there was going to be this whole, well, you just assume that I don't dance kind of conversation. Like,
that you're would have been fantastic.
You're assuming that I'm straight, which would have been brilliant.
Yeah.
But it was all cut.
Yeah.
It's just like to tone down the gay agenda.
This is very Gatiss-y still, though, isn't
it? Yeah, it is. I mean, sometimes with a Gatiss script, I feel like I can see the whiteboard from the meeting. Like, okay, we want 50s, we want the coronation, we want blank-faced people, we want Maureen Lippman on television. It's like there's a checklist and the episode moves through the checklist ponderously, and you get to the end and you're like, okay, well, we ticked off everything. Did anything happen?
Yeah.
But I did, yeah. I like the writing of the kitchen sink drama, like in the house. It was terribly performed. I thought the mum was okay, but the dad was so bad that everyone seemed to be – it was – you know, I don't know if you've ever performed with someone who's chewing the scenery, like most of the people who perform with me have. But you end up having to really temper your performance to deal with – what they're doing. Like, it's just you'd never really enjoy it. No one ever has a good time because it's like, well, we just have to work around this person because they can't take direction, they can't listen. Or maybe the director was just like, oh yeah, I trust you to do what you're doing.
Yeah.
Which it feels like in this instance. Like everyone was just doing whatever they felt like.
I wonder if that's a tonal thing that's coming from Tennant. And I could have been a lot cheekier with that, but I actually mean this seriously.
If other people are rising to the sort of level of artificiality.
He is the showrunner on screen anyway.
Yeah, I guess you do take your cues from the main actor, the star of the show. But if anyone really knew what they were doing, they'd be taking their cues from Billy Piper, because the way the show has been set up in the modern era is that the Doctor is the second banana. Like the Doctor gets to do all the mucking around, so our viewpoint character is the most normal one, being Billy or Paul Fremer or Catherine Tate. And, you know, that was the beauty of casting someone like Catherine Tate, is that the Doctor could occasionally be the viewpoint character, because she could be the lunatic for an episode and you could flip back and forth. But, yeah, I guess if you are taking your cues from a prize ham, it's difficult not to put the glaze on.
And where are you placing the maraschino cherry?
Right up the top.
You look at it's, you really got me thinking. You look at how Pertwee would have played this, who really was a prize porcine for all of his years and was still doing Navy like you. And really over the top thing. But when he came into Doctor Who, I think he and Tennant's personality were probably not that different on set. You know, there is a sense of I am the entire room. We hear that from folk who've worked on the thing. And not a bad thing, simply the way the actors work. But Pertwee would have, I suspect, done a whole lot of sotto voce in this one that might have been quite nice, especially the snarly scene.
Yeah, it feels like Tennant's taking his cues from, you know, Graham Williams era Tom Baker.
Yeah, no. That's true. I think that's it. Because, I mean, trying to think of a Doctor Who does anger really well, and it is early Tom.
Yeah.
You know, he's terrific.
He's terrifying.
Jaw sets and all
that. Also, when he's angry about something, like, just ludicrous. You're like, why are you angry about that? It's not something people get angry about, but whatever. You're out of space, man.
Yeah, no, it's aggressive almost football. Certainly something that happened in the green room shortly earlier.
Yeah, it was. Someone nicked his fags.
He'd been out of the pub for far too long, like an hour. I had never noticed until now that they live on Florizel Street, which was the original name of Coronation Street.
No.
When it was in development.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's set during the coronation. I'm like, oh, that is so cute. It's such a little, you know, a little delicious nugget that if you know Coronation Street, you're like, oh, Florizel Street, who was the prince from Sleeping Beauty, I think.
Oh, I'm not sure.
That's what what's his face? Tony Warren named Coronation Street after Prince Florizel because there was a picture on the wall and was like, oh, yeah, that'll do.
And Pat Phoenix had played it naked on a cushion at the age of four.
She probably did.
It's very Gatesy though, isn't it?
Yeah,
and it is, and that's why I love him.
Well, this whole thing is this sort of incredible love letter to early TV.
Yeah.
And it says in the script that 1953 is the first time that something is watched by millions and millions of people.
Yeah.
It's really the birth of TV as a sort of popular medium. And, you know, there's a sort of through line from that, obviously, to the fact that we're watching Doctor Who, that Doctor Who starts and Coronation Street starts, you know, just a very few years after this. Mm. And what we do see on TV is sort of, apart from Muffin the Mule, obviously, is also rather
which
worthy.
Was an early Gerry Anderson?
No, it wasn't.
Oh, no, but he was the Torchy the Light Boy.
he owes his career to Roberta Tovey, who was a singer who sounded exactly like the dear woman. What was her name? Began with an M. Who did Muffin. Muffin the Mule went forever.
Forever.
For absolute. Oh, my Lord.
Also,
really?
it's very Carry On to put Muffin the Mule in the script because it's basically terrible British slang now for crumpet. Muffin the Mule is has in later years become something other than a children's cartoon with a puppet.
What do they do with Maureen Lipman?
I got distracted before. Maureen Lipman I've loved for a very long time. When I was a kid, I had like this tiny black and white television bought for $50.
I have exactly this story. Keep going.
Is it about agony?
Yes.
Yes.
Watching it under the covers on a tiny black and white television.
It was on very late. It was on the ABC or something, very late at night, and it was just the most glorious show. There were gay people in it, which was exciting. I was like, oh, my God, there's gay people on the television.
They exist.
It's late at night.
So this is 80s, early 80s?
Yeah, very early
80s. Yeah, very early. So it was on like, I think, 11 o'clock something on Friday night.
She was an agony aunt at a newspaper. Like, she wrote an agony column for a newspaper. She was married to, I think, Simon Williams in the show
from
Upstairs, Downstairs, and obviously Doctor Who. Chunky and Gilmore.
She had a sort of stoner musician friend called Andy Evil. And like the gay couple who were like the neighbors, that was the first gay people that I remember ever seeing on TV.
It was so good.
I've never been able to find it.
Oh, no, same. And it, like, I remember there was an episode that completely destroyed me when she gave birth. Did you ever see that one?
I don't remember that.
Anyway, she has a baby and she names it after someone. And, like, the husband comes in and goes, oh, we should call it so-and-so. And she's like, oh, he'd love that. And then she realizes, oh, he's died, hasn't he? And you're like, no! It is, yeah. He's taking an overdose. They try and wake him up in the shower. And it's like, it's very funny and it's hilarious. And then you get to the very end of the episode, you're like, ugh, you just tore my heart out of my chest. I love it. She was amazing.
It was really good. And so I knew.
This sounds like a Russell T Davies.
It really does, doesn't it?
I'm an old person. He would have probably been a teenager. But yeah. It was a long time ago. Also, they don't repeat things in England. So it would have been on and then never seen again. But yeah, it was my favorite. I loved it so much. And then when I lived in the UK in the early 90s, she was on TV all the time. She did ads for BT, you know, their Telstra. So she was always on the television.
There was a sitcom called All at Number 20, I want to say.
Something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think she's marvelous. And I do remember being incredibly excited that she was going to do Doctor Who.
And she's such a big star. Like, she's huge. So, yeah, it was very exciting, even though all of her scenes were done in a cupboard like 3 weeks later.
Yeah. In one morning.
They were actually filmed at Alexandra Palace.
Oh, wow. Yeah. See, this is something that I feel. With the older, now I love that we're talking about old Doctor Who and older Doctor Who, but with this series, like, I feel like season 11 has done something that these were never really good at, which is explore the history of something and really give you a sense of what was happening, what was going on. This, you get a sense that, yes, the coronation was fun and, yeah, it's at Alexandra Palace. But to find out any of that stuff, you have to go online and research it yourself. Yeah.
And it's kind of background.
Yeah. It's just like – yeah, it's like it's just colour. But, you know, I have enjoyed that in – Season 11, when you get King James and the witch burning, you're like, oh, yeah, this is really what it was like.
It's fulfilling its original remit.
Yeah, you're learning things. Whereas this, it's just like, oh, yeah, that's where they made TV. And I'm like, what, Alexandra Palace? Why is there a big antenna there? Like, it's, I don't know, I felt like it was giving lip service to history as opposed to, like, just really throwing us in the middle of it.
I think that Series 11 is the first time that, like, Doctor Who doesn't do that when it goes back to the past in the new era. Mm. It is, I think About Time calls it kind of theme park Britain or heritage park Britain, you know, where it just hits the beats. These are the things that we know about the 1950s. And because we don't know that much about the 1950s in Britain, we have to have all these sort of Elvis, Ed Sullivan references at the beginning just to put us in the right sort of time frame.
Weirdly inappropriate. Also, I love that he knows when they've gone to, but he's missed continents by quite.
Well, it makes a change. Normally it's he's the wrong, you know, there's one digit wrong in the date, you know, like Tooth and Claw earlier in the year.
It's meant to be the 70s. So,
the original script concept,
had Elvis in it?
No. Was set later during like the birth of
rock and roll, three years later.
Yeah. So The Wire wasn't The Wire. It was a living song.
Oh, yeah, that's hard to dramatize.
Billy Crystal sung everything.
You could have just been day and night chasing the world.
See, this sounds like a Virgin New Adventures.
It really does.
And it was called Mr. Sandman or Sonic Doom.
Oh, that episode happened.
It took another 10 years.
And again, it was difficult to dramatize.
But he never lets something go, does he?
No, his recycle bin is obviously very full. Just delete it, mate. Build a bridge, move on. But yeah, I liked that it was at the coronation. Like, that gave me a sense, you know. But again, this has been a problem of many episodes this season. Like, you know, obviously you've got coming up the terrible 2012 Olympics. But yeah, like the coronation, you're like, oh, it was a big party and everyone was excited. And it's like, it's a handful of people in a room watching TV and then it's a handful of people standing at a trestle table with some bunting.
All duplicated by CGI. There's lots of people who look identical to one another at the party.
It makes me think of that French and Saunders on the Titanic when they're like told to don't do too much. They're like, I'm going to wave a baby.
iceberg, mercy for my dead baby.
In fact, it pissed down at the coronation and all of the street parties were cancelled and everyone was watching TV. That's why everyone remembers watching TV in the room.
Yeah, so that's another, you know, like I feel like, you know, paying lip service to history, you miss out on the verisimilitude of what is what England was really like. Yeah. Like, bad enough you're filming it in Wales and trying to make it be London. That I believe. Yeah. But then can't you go the extra step and... I don't know. We could have done without Derek from EastEnders screaming at people and had a bit more excitement about the coronation. I did love that they had the actual coronation on the television. Yeah. Like, that is a nightmare footage to get cleared.
Right, okay.
I know for a fact from having had contact with the palace for just a photo of Mom in her chair. It's, you know... And I guess the BBC owns probably the footage. A decent copyright of it. But
she's a fan.
She is a fan. Apparently she got the Series 1 box set for Christmas in 2005 or something like that.
Took it up to Balmoral.
That's it. That's why I always feel a bit bad about Tooth and Claw, where the doctor makes it very clear that they're all werewolves.
That's RTD. Yeah. You know, she probably had a laugh, looked side eyes at Philip.
You know? Oh, my God, I've got the best story about Philip.
Is it repeatable?
Yes. He got lost in the River Caves ride at Sydney Lunar Park, which is a ride that you just sit in until the end.
Right.
And he got off halfway through and then couldn't find his way out.
Wow.
How gloriously Philip is that? Getting lost on a ride you don't get off.
Terrifying. Terrifying tiny children passing by.
Oh, it was in I think 45. So like it was before. Before, like, it was a sign of things to come, obviously.
Yeah, before he went quite mad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's always one foot there, wasn't there?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I love him. He's ridiculous.
Talked about Britain at the time and how it was reflected, but we're only seeing, as Russell likes to do, it's starting to grate on me that it's always so suburban. It's not even at the scale of urban. So there's a lot of other things happening. I've been reading again about Diana Dawes, the power that she had in 1953 as a bigger film star, more highly paid than a cabinet minister, looked like Marilyn Monroe, but actually was a star before Monroe. They're all based on Jean Harlow. Well, and any drag queen, Rhonda Birchmore, drag queen you would care to cite. But so there was a polarity in Britain that there were also figures of great height and silliness and also a celebratory notion of, well, what do you want to call it, capitalism? Do you want to call it sexuality? Do you want to call it the burgeoning after the Festival of Britain in 51, where I want to see a story set in that with a space needle and the dining room, awesome, gorgeous. And it looks like Dalek City, you know, off the back of TV21. But, yeah, so the scale that he always brings it down to, I get that because he loves – it's a soap. Doctor Who is now a soap. And he's
trying to make it relatable.
Soap. But, again – look, this is my problem with Mark Gatiss. It's being let loose in a lolly shop, but you've only got 30 seconds. So you throw everything in the bag and then you've got to sit down and work out what's going to make it on screen. Adam said it. I don't know that we ever actually get – well, you get a lot of rumination afterwards, don't you? Because you haven't really had a full feed. So, again, with this one
– ironic, given how many times we hear the word hungry.
Yeah.
Tag.
It's in Paradise Towers again, isn't it?
I think Paradise Towers is a lot more successful at actually setting a mood in a small environment. Thank you. Because that's exactly a parallel that I'd be looking at. I get much more of a sense of – it's J.G. Ballard. We talked about it. But much more of a sense of world than I get here.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of – I don't know, thinking about the kitchen sink drama part of it, like the – well, it's a lounge room sitting around the television drama. But the – you know, there's just a couple of moments where – I was like, yeah, I get what's going on here, but you haven't really addressed why. Like, there's a brief moment of, I didn't fight a war for this, which is where – so men were emasculated by the fact that they came back from war and all the women were working and they all had jobs and they were all, you know, like Joan Crawford, Mildred Pierce was sort of the type of woman that was on screen. So they were replaced very quickly by your Diana Dawes and your Marilyn Monroes trying to make women seem subservient and keeping house. And, you know, the women wouldn't have done that easily given that they had the run of the country for, you know, the last 5 or 6 years. So the fact that the woman is such a milquetoast, like she just sort of puts up with this ranting, screaming behavior. So when she throws him out, it feels so out of character. Yeah. I think that's a failure in not only performance but writing, because she has no dialogue apart from, no, don't. Like, she sounds like Jackie O. stop it, Kyle. Oh, Kyle, you can't say that. I've got to cover my ass with the broadcasting authority.
There's no room on the sofa for anyone else.
But, yeah, I think there was a reason for all this behaviour. There was a reason men were put at the head of the household all of a sudden and made the breadwinners. Like, that was a cultural necessity, because there were all these men come back from war with no jobs to do. Yeah. So it was like, well, you go and do your wife's job. She can stay home. And that was something that happened. But also this weird Union Flag, Union Jack business that comes out of nowhere. Like, I mean, it's fascinating and you learn something.
She didn't know that last season when she was hanging from a barrel.
No! It's like when I found out the red ensign, the Australian red flag, that's only so flown at sea. Before, you know, the craziness of the Australian flag, like either the red or blue were fine. You could fly them anywhere in Australia. They were both our flag. And then one day it was decided, the red one can just be for sailors. <That's it. laughs> I love finding out things about flags.
Well, that line, in fact, it's one of my favourite moments, is where Billy yells at Mr. Connolly for, you know, only an idiot hangs the Union flag upside down, which is just tremendously great. And then she sort of ducks out of frame and runs off as if, you know, she's going to be grabbed by a sort of a cartoon hunter or something.
Because there's a lot of Looney Tunes, Chuck Jones direction. Yeah. They're really troping the entire, we said trope. That
period. Yeah. I mean, that is sort of fun. I think, too, with Mr. Connolly's generation, they're about to be replaced culturally as well. And so he's looking into his own obsolescence, I think. And you've got Tommy, and we've said before, Tommy's speech is like upsettingly vague.
Yeah.
And very on the nose as well. Like, just even the use of the word fascism to describe
I think
Nazis
what you're saying
wrong.
About it being set later is where that speech comes from. Because that feels very out of place in 53.
Yeah.
Like, 53 was very much about conformity, and that kind of change hadn't started to happen. Like, the kind of wave of youth feeling empowered. Like, you know, like, they'd only just got out of rationing. So no one felt empowered. Everyone was hungry.
Actually, that's a good point, because Murray Gold's score is anachronistic.
Yeah.
Should not be coming in for another 4 years. They were still listening to Swing.
They were still, like it was all Sinatra and you know, that kind of thing.
We have to wait until Vicky comes along for sort of proper youth culture. That's really what we're looking forward to.
But like the fact that the Beatles are 10 years off and he's talking like they've been around for 5 years.
Yeah.
It feels very, you know, out of place. But I can see if it was written intending to be much later in the 50s or early 60s.
And rock and roll didn't hit the UK until much later than it hit the US as well.
Yeah. Yeah, we had it earlier than they did.
Yeah. But we're a very small country. It only takes telling three people about something for it to become a problem.
It's huge. It's huge.
There were actually only three people in the country at the time.
That's true. They were all Menzies. But, I felt like it's just, I mean, we're analysing it to death. It's a bit of fluff television, and it's not the strongest episode in the season.
No.
And it has come off the back of a fairly powerful two-parter, which has its own flaws. But, it just feels like a it's just like, oh, I don't know. It's like when you're in a plane waiting to land. Well, I think like I'm gonna get to something good next because the next two episodes are amazing.
Yeah. Well, think about The Long Game. That's where we were this time last year.
Yeah.
Which again, like, ends up in retrospect having more to do with the season, but like seemed at the time to be sort of filler. I think this looks more interesting than that.
Yeah.
But there's really much less to it. I mean,
yeah, the thing with The Long Game though is, and this is one of the problems with this episode, I think, is that The Long Game, you've got some of the best actors working in Britain, like Anna Maxwell-Martin. You've got Simon Pegg,
Tamsin Gregg.
Tamsin Gregg,
for God's sake,
just a little cameo. Yeah. Like, and what's her face that's now in Black Lightning? And it's like, it's all about the performances, and they're great performances. Whereas all the performances in this are just in search of. Yeah. Something in the script that's not there, like looking for subtext that's not there, or obliterating it with shouting and carry on. It's, I feel like this is probably the weakest Uris Lynn episode, and he's a great director of action and a director of the camera, but I think he's just.
He does have Fear Her later in the year.
Yeah, I know.
In fact, there was one time, I mean, they brought this forward in the running. They were nearly going to have, like, Fear Her and this, like, consecutively, and they're so similar.
Yeah.
Like, they both have, you know, angry, abusive fathers. They both have a big media event which is going to cause sort of widespread havoc and chaos. They have people translated into sort of some kind of visual medium. It ends with a big party in the street. Like, it's the same. Yeah.
Also, it's I think both of these episodes we get to see why the Tennant and Piper team is such a team, because when you take one part away, what's left is kind of just flapping around in the breeze.
Yeah, you have some time without the Doctor, don't you?
He turns into a drawing.
Yeah. So it is. It's the reverse.
Yeah, it's essentially the same story, but flipped around. Yeah. Just as Tennant's quite annoying when Rose isn't around. Rose is quite annoying when the Doctor's not around.
I actually do think she gets a good moment in this episode, though, where, you know, she and the Doctor are separated. He goes off to chase the police and she investigates the television, then does her funny line to Connolly and then goes and speaks to Mr. Magpie.
This is what I mean, though. Like, you know, when you've got them, they can be separate in the same episode because you cut back and forth between them and they're still both there. But when only one of them is in charge of the story, it's like Tommy's meant to be fulfilling the Rose role, and you know, he's a nice enough kid, I'm sure, but he's a little bit dull.
he's like 29 or something.
No, he's 23.
I thought he was like a 30-year-old doing the sort of squeaky teen Simpsons.
I assume anyone attractive on television is 29, just to make me feel better about myself.
You know, they actually originally wanted Nicholas Holt to.
Oh, he'd have been great. Him.
Is he too young?
He was too young at the time. He was 17 and he would have been playing a 17-year-old.
Oh, no, the 17 thing is more about the amount of days
you have. It's because he's a minor and therefore, it wouldn't have worked.
You've got to have a parent. It's expensive.
Yeah. It just wouldn't have worked with the amount he needed to be in the episode. Yeah.
Oh, that's frustrating. He would have been really good.
Mm.
Up against Ed Connolly, though?
Yeah, well, see, I reckon maybe he couldn't. I watched EastEnders a lot, and there's a kid in that who is dreadful. And he's like a big theatre star, he's a great singer, and he spent like a year doing episodes with Timothy West playing his grandfather. And I'm like, how do you go to work every day with Timothy West and not learn anything? Like, he was just abominable. I'm like, there is this powerhouse, this talented, incredible performer in front of you every day.
And he's known to be generous on set with younger, ingenue performers, or aging juveniles.
Yes.
He's really known to be generous.
Yeah, so, this kid, other than filling out his jeans well, was doing nothing.
Have you heard the David Tennant, Jodie Whittaker podcast. David Tennant does the podcast interviewing Jodie Whittaker. And
I worry about him doing a podcast. Like, does anyone get a word in?
No. It's really good. It's Olivia Colman, then Whoopi Goldberg. Yes. And as we record, we've just had Jodie Whittaker. And she talks about working with Peter O'Toole.
When she was a kid.
Yeah. And she spent her whole time asking him what was it like to be in King Ralph. Talking about how great King Ralph was.
And he was like, what?
Oh, dear, I love her even more.
She's the best. I've worked with Olivia.
I don't care about him. Dear. But, yeah, I think, I don't know, it's... He's like, yeah, he was no good in EastEnders either. He's very annoying. I want to say that the whole problem with the episode is him. And it radiates outwards.
I think, too, that it kind of doesn't have much ambition to say anything. And Gatiss does atmosphere. And, you know, there's a very sort of League of Gentlemen feel to the faceless grandma, you know, knocking on the floor upstairs, you know, like David upstairs in the local shop sort of thing. And she's turned into a monster. We don't know what it is. I mean, that's super atmospheric, and that works very well. And there's set pieces, but there's nothing very much to say. And it is... You know, you've got this sort of central thing where television is becoming a mass, you know, a form of mass entertainment, which is going to change the landscape of the world and change, you know, people. And you've got the grandmother warning us that it turns your brains to mush and makes them leak out of your ears. And if only it had had something to say about that. You know, like if The Wire had been successful in some way, not taking people's faces or something, but, you know, if we'd had a sort of comedy beat at the end where the reason that we all sit staring at this thing for hours every day.
She did much better when she moved to Baltimore and got her own show.
I mean, look, the Betamax bit at the end I found hilarious and cute.
I like the label where he's written something in Gallifreyan on it and has crossed it out because he's taped something else.
Maybe she did succeed because Magpie Electricals exists forever.
In
the new series.
I kind of like that's another one of those weird things where the production team are doing something that the writers don't seem to notice or care about.
I think they bring it back about 6 or 7 times.
Yeah, it keeps coming back.
It works very well in The Beast Below because obviously that's a, you know, theme park Britain heritage thing.
And they also write into the animation of Power of the Daleks.
Oh, yay. But that's what I mean. It's like it's not written into these things. It's just kind of sticky taped on. But like, you know, the same orange jumpsuit being used for 14 things. It's like, oh, yeah, we made one. We'll keep using it and we'll keep the stupid logo on it that means it came from this place. Even when someone's wearing it that shouldn't have the logo. Yeah, there are a few times where I think the foot was off the pedal, especially in the Moffat years where – like he'd written the episode and he was happy to do interviews about the show, but I think he was very much not paying attention to the actual production as it was going on.
In contrast with Russell, who...
Oh, it was all over it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Russell wouldn't let a book or a Big Finish episode go out that was vaguely similar. Whereas... You know, you get Moffat episodes that you're like, this is the same plot as a thing I just listened to like 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Well, this is the same plot as a thing from that book that, you know, that comic story. And you're like, wouldn't you have said, oh, no to that if you'd read it?
So it has meant that we've got some great Big Finish.
Oh, yeah. No, it's amazing.
In the meantime, because he wasn't as controlling.
Yes.
Instead of getting... What was it, Mr. Stream in that Lost audio? Like, it was supposed to be the master and Tractators, like, Lost story that he finished. And he was like, no, you can't have the master. So the character is just called Mr. Stream for the entire thing, or Professor Stream or something.
Well, they could have just postponed it.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, but I kind of like that Russell was that hands-on. Yeah, I just felt like there's being hands off and then, I don't know, I think the Metabilis thing was the thing that made me go, ah, yeah, you're not there.
See, my theory
you're
is
busy
that
over at Sherlock.
My theory is that John Pertwee's doctor can't pronounce the names of planets.
Which
is,
no, I think that's great.
That's it. And so he gets Metabolus wrong and he gets Spyridon wrong.
Sontaran.
Yeah, that's right. I did think it was worth noting the return of the insufficiently executed villain from the Dawn of Time. Mm. They were a big staple, obviously, of the late 70s. It's our first one of the new series, and there'll be another one next week.
Oh, yay. I have to say I did enjoy the scariness of it. It's just that it didn't pay off with anything that scary.
Yeah.
Like the chanting of hungry, the faces being pulled into the television, all of that was really effective. But I want to be able to get to the end of the episode and be afraid to turn the television on.
Yeah.
Whereas this, I was like, meh.
It's something that Doctor Who in this era does. I think I remember being tentative walking down the street, not wanting to put my hand on any Sulu bins, you know, like after series one. And it should have done that, shouldn't it? It should have made kids to turn.
It should be like the exploding bubble wrap, which I thought was ludicrous but terrifying. And the same with, well, I had the same problem with bubble wrap from Ark in Space. But also, like, just, you know, Moffat managed to make us terrified of graveyards and statues. Mm, yeah. Like, it's Doctor Who can be terrifying, make the mundane terrifying, and we should all be afraid to turn the television on. And it's almost like, as a television show, that's a bold choice to make. But they kind of, I felt like it just didn't get there in the end.
Well, dear listener, we've finally got our faces back and they're all looking a bit hairier than we remember. So we'll be back next week to settle down with a mortgage and some carpets in the impossible planet. In the meantime, you can find us at flightthroughentirety.com, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and Apple Podcasts, and at FTE Podcast on Twitter. You can also find more up-to-the-minute takes on Doctor Who at Jodie Into Terror, which is at jodieintoterror.com, Jodie Into Terror on Apple Podcasts, and at Jodie Into Terror on Twitter. And, of course, there's our James Bond commentary podcast, Bondfinger, which is at bondfinger.com, Bondfinger on Facebook and Apple Podcasts, and at Bondfingercast on Twitter. Where can people find you, Adam?
At Adam Richard on Twitter and the Instagram, and Fabulous Adam Richard on the Facebook, the feces book. And I have a monthly newsletter that I've been writing. Monthly, supposedly. You can get that at adamrichard.com.
Brilliant. Awesome. All right. Until next time, may all your evil nemeses be sufficiently executed enough. Thank you very much for listening and good night.
Good night.
Bye.
Good day.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Nathan Bottomley, James Selwood, Richard Stone, and special guest star Adam Richard. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb, strings performance by Jane Orberg. This episode, Put a Glaze On, was recorded on the 17th of February 2019 and released on the 28th of April. The Wire was undoubtedly a particularly evil villain, but I can't help thinking that we'll all be really feeling her absence when it comes time for the coronation of King Charles III. Okay, I think that's good. It didn't get there in the end. That's actually exactly it. That's really our takeaway.
There's so much good stuff in it. It just, you know, at the end I'm like, oh, well, I've got some lolly wrappers. I don't feel the best afterwards.
All right. What do you think?
It's a really good one.
That's probably
the name of the episode.
I think it'll be fun.
Isn't it?
I'm still thinking something about barinas.
You could pop that in later when you do the Asylum of the Daleks.
Barina of the Daleks.
Barina
and the Daleks. Sorry.
Delta and the Barinament. No, sorry.
Okay. So, yeah, the title would probably be something you said.
Oh, don't.
Yeah, no. Yeah, it's usually something that. the guest says, at least on their first. First viewing.
Did you use the C-bomb?
No, yeah, no, that was you.
I said, oh, the C-bomb.
There you go. That's the
title. But I didn't use the
C-bomb. What, Coronation? Yeah, I did say Coronation Street. Yeah. I love Florizel Street. If you ever want to watch, it's far superior to an Adventure in Time and Space. The Road to Coronation Street is a brilliant.
I have it on my brain.
It's the same kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's about Tony Warren creating Coronation Street. And it is. And it's got Kat Slater from EastEnders as Pat Phoenix. And she is brilliant. And Ina Sharples is old mate from Open All Hours.
Not Linda Berlin.
Yes.
Linda Barron.
Well, we own her. Linda Barron. We own her.
The other Barron.
The other one. Linda Barron, we own many times.
Yeah, three times.
When was the last time you watched The Gunfighters? Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Because, you know, she sings. She's in that.
Yeah, she sings the theme.
It's not really funny.
It's great. Right. Oh, no, it's superb.
Yeah, because Dodo's had of accents.
Yeah. I think Dodo's at her best in that one.
That is her best one, I think.
Do you know what I've noticed? I've been watching Game of Thrones from the beginning with the other half, and I had never realised that old mate Littlefinger from Queer as Folk, Gillan,
I think.
Yeah. He dips into the hat of accents. Like when you're watching it week to week, it's fine. But when you're watching more than one back to back, you're like, oh, you're from somewhere different this way. he's all over the show.
One moment he's from Manchester, the next moment he's from Wales.
Isn't he Irish actually in reality? Yeah.
Yeah. I think
so. Yeah, one way, yeah, he's seriously, he moves around.
Up and down what was the thing?
Rattling up and down the M4.
It reminds me of, what's that, yeah, when Pierce Brosnan says to Mrs. Doubtfire, your accent's a bit muddled. Oh, yes, like your tan.
There should be someone on set always saying that to Pierce Brosnan.